You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Erica Nelson reporting for the Body Pro. You're about to sit in on one of the daily press conferences at CROI 2008, an intimate gathering where researchers discuss the findings of some of the most noteworthy studies at the conference. In this podcast, doctors Susan Bookbinder and Michael Robertson recap some surprising new data from the STEP study, a phase 2 trial in which volunteers taking an experimental Merck HIV vaccine were found to be more likely to become HIV infected than volunteers who did not receive the vaccine. Then, Drs. Ronald Desrosiers and Neil Nathanson discuss what the STEP study findings mean for the future of HIV vaccine development.
I presented the efficacy results from the STEP study, which was a test of concept trial of Merck's adenoviral replication-incompetent adenoviral trivalent vaccine to either protect against HIV infection or reduce early viral set point. And the trial was conducted in such a way that we got a very quick answer to that question. 33 months after the first participant was enrolled, we got a very definitive answer in our first interim analysis that the vaccine neither provided protection against infection nor was able to control viral replication. We went on and did post-hoc analyses, and in doing post-hoc analyses, you always need to be careful that this is more for hypothesis generation than getting definitive results. But we did see an excess number of infections in the vaccine group compared with the placebo group. And we then proceeded to ask three questions. One was this effect real or could it be confounded by other differences in demographic or risk variables between vaccine and placebo recipients? The second was there a possibility that the vaccine, if there was an increased number of infections, that might be just in particular subgroups, or did it apply to the entire population? And the third question was this just a transient effect around the time of vaccination, or is it a durable effect? And I'll give you our preliminary answers to those three questions. In response to this question of after you control for other covariates, demographic and behavioral variables, does this affect this apparent increase in the number of HIV infections in the vaccine compared to the placebo arm, appears to hold. So we believe that there may be an increased number of infections associated with receipt of the vaccine. I want to make it very clear that the vaccine did not cause any infections, but it may be that it in some way made individuals who had received the vaccine more susceptible to becoming infected if they were later exposed. This is still a hypothesis. We still have additional testing to do, things like herpes testing, HLA typing, looking for clusters of sexual transmission at given sites that could have created a spurious result. But at this point, we don't see any other explanation for the increased number of infections in the vaccine group. The second question was, well, is that true for all vaccine recipients, or was that limited to certain subgroups? And what we saw was that it appeared to be most heavily evident in those individuals who were either uncircumcised or who had pre-existing immunity to adenovirus type 5, which it was the vector, again, used in this vector-based vaccine. Individuals with both of those risk factors appear to be at higher risk of acquiring infection, in excess of fourfold increased risk if they got the vaccine compared with getting the placebo. On the other side, individuals who were both circumcised and AD5 seronegative appeared to be at no increased risk in any of our multivariate models. And individuals with one or the other risk factor, but not both, appear to have some intermediate level of risk. And then the third question about the durability of this increased number of infections, it's difficult for us to give an answer to that question at this time. It's really important that we continue to follow the study volunteers, and we are following the study volunteers in STEP, and they've been really a remarkable group and are continuing in follow-up in very, very large proportions. What we can say is it doesn't appear that this increased infection rate, though, was just in the peri-vaccination period, that it appeared to persist through 52 weeks of follow-up. So that's my summary of our STEP study results.
So the data that I showed was really looking at the laboratory investigations in the STEP study to help try and better understand the findings that Susan just summarized. So this vaccine was designed specifically to elicit HIV-specific T cells. It was not designed to elicit neutralizing antibodies, and there was a lot of discussion about the need for doing this. And I think the reason for going to this approach has been something that many people have been looking at over the last 10 or 15 years, showing the role that T cells have a critical role in the control of HIV. So this concept that a vaccine that elicited T cells was something that we tried to test in this study. So when we saw that the vaccine was not efficacious, one of the first questions we asked was, did the vaccine just not elicit T cell responses in the people that became infected? So I showed data that indicate that we were getting T cell responses, at least measured by one particular assay called the gamma interferon ELISpot assay, which is a pretty standard assay for measuring these types of responses. And when we compared the responses in people that later became infected to those that so far have not become infected, we didn't really see any significant difference in that. So that the lack of efficacy was not explained by the vaccine not being immunogenic, or that the people that became infected were just not responders to the vaccine. They appeared to respond just as well as the main cohort. We also noted, again, as we had seen in our phase 1 trials with this same vaccine, that people that had high pre-existing immunity to the vector itself, adenovirus type 5, they did respond, but at a lower level than people that had lower levels of pre-existing immunity to the vector. So again, this does not explain the finding that Susan just described, where when we look at different subgroups of people where we saw increased numbers of infection, that was more concentrated in the people that had high pre-existing immunity to the vector, whereas the immune responses we were getting were, if anything, slightly lower in that group. So we did not have a clear correlation or explanation for why we were not seeing efficacy of the vaccine. We've done some further explanations trying to look at any potential mechanism that could explain why we're seeing increased numbers of infection, and particularly why we might see it in those subgroups of people that Susan talked about. One of the initial reactions that people had when they heard the results of our trial was that the vaccine was stimulating T cell responses to HIV. It's known from, you know, a lot of work before that HIV likes to infect T cells, and it actually likes to infect activated T cells. And so one hypothesis that people had was that the vaccine was eliciting T cells that were then becoming easier to infect. And as I mentioned, if anything, the T cell responses to the HIV inserts in the vaccine were lower in the people where we saw the most increase in infection. So that did not really explain that finding. So then another hypothesis people have formulated is that it's not T cell responses to the HIV inserts, but to the vector itself. You know, adenovirus is a common community infection. Many people have been exposed to this. And just like any virus infection, you can mount an immune response to that. So by administering the vaccine, were we actually activating T cells to the vector itself that, again, were making it easier for HIV to infect those cells? And so we showed some of the data, some very preliminary data, looking at T cell responses to the vector itself. And while we do see that vaccination does increase the number of vector-specific T cells, again, if anything, that was lower in people that had high pre-existing immunity to the vector, which again would not explain the findings that we had observed, where the increased number of infections appeared to be more common in those that had high pre-existing immunity. So I think at this point we don't have a clear explanation for either the lack of vaccine efficacy or anything that might explain why we saw an increased number of infections in the subgroups that Susan described. We do have plans for a number of different laboratory investigations. We have samples obtained from all the participants in the trial, and so either studies that we're going to do ourselves, but also we want to engage the broader scientific community to see, are there hypotheses that could be tested? Could the samples from this trial help us to better understand these findings? Because we think this is a very significant study, a very significant finding, have broad implications for the whole field. And so we want to engage the broader scientific community as well to help try and understand what these findings might mean. But right now, I think we have more questions than we have answers.
My job at this particular session was largely to summarize why a vaccine for HIV is so difficult. And I spent much of the time enumerating point after point why HIV is so particularly difficult to make a vaccine against. Immune evasion strategies, highly variable sequences, a long list of reasons why a vaccine should be so difficult. And basically to come to the conclusion that it really shouldn't be a big surprise that the three efficacy trials we've had have not worked yet. We're really dealing with something very, very difficult. And then I spent the last part raising the possibility that maybe our nation's vaccine effort should consider taking an alternate course or changing emphasis a bit in how we're tackling the problem. I think it's fundamentally a good thing that we've had these three efficacy trials. We've learned that they didn't work. But at this point in time, I'm not so sure that having a fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh efficacy trial that doesn't work is going to be very useful to us, and that maybe now is the time to step back and try to make some creative discoveries, fund some novel ideas, do some discovery research that will hopefully teach us how to make a vaccine that can work.
So my talk really was sort of complementary to Ron's, and just mention a couple of points I picked up on. One was that, as you probably are aware, there are a lot of established vaccines that we have that work against virus infections. They're mainly against acute virus infections, but also we know that most of them work, if maybe all of them, by eliciting antibodies, so-called neutralizing antibodies, that will basically block the virus. And for HIV, this is a problem, and I went into that in some detail. The reason it's a problem is not that people don't make, when they're infected, antibodies, but that the virus has this incredible ability, and I'm sure you've all heard this over and over again, to throw off mutations, and they, in turn, some of them can escape the antibody response. So you're constantly chasing this virus as it morphs into a different variant. And nobody has really managed to figure out how to make an antibody response that will deal with that situation. And in fact, it's more probably comparable to some of the parasitic infections where the parasitic agent has the same properties. So I talked about that. And another issue that, again, enlarges on what Ron was talking about was the use of animal models, and partly because we have a pretty good animal model, which is the SIV, the simian equivalent of HIV in monkeys, and also because for ethical reasons, we can do studies which you can't do in humans, namely to try a potential candidate vaccine and then to actually challenge with a virulent SIV that will cause an AIDS-like illness in the monkeys. So we talked about how those models can be best used really as a shortcut or a help in trying to find a potential immunogen which is more promising than the ones that have been tried to date. And again, with a conclusion that we need to make sure we fund to a reasonable level what Ron and I call discovery research, which is more sort of basic research, because in this particular case, it's clear we need some more basic knowledge in order to solve these scientific problems, which are really the impediment.
Neil also highlighted some improvements that can be gained from technologies and teachings that are already available today and used as an example, Botswana. And so the vaccine research agenda has to be complemented by other research agendas focused on prevention. And as I said earlier in the week, the conference has highlighted triumphs and failures, successes, and defeats. This is an area where there hasn't been success, but remember that circumcision is highly effective in preventing acquisition of HIV and other sexually transmitted disease, and also improving the vaginal health of women, partners of those who are circumcised. There are many posters and presentations on PrEP agents, pre-exposure prophylaxis agents, that show promise. And so we need to move forward on several research fronts given the obstacles for an effective vaccine. So with that said, why don't we just open it up for questions? John Cohen in the back of the room.
Can you separate out the role of circumcision from the high Ad5 antibodies or the lack of circumcision and infection of vaccinated people? I was confused by what the bottom line is. I know there's a combination of lack of circumcision and high Ad5, but can you separate it out and make sense of
it? It's challenging. We have small numbers, and what we can say is that if you look at the circumcised group overall, there was no apparent increase in the risk of HIV infection in the vaccine compared to the placebo. But when we looked at the uncircumcised men overall, there was an increased risk in the rate of infection in the vaccine group compared with the placebo group. Now, we know that some of those men are Ad5 seropositive as well, and some are Ad5 seronegative. And what we were able to say is for the subgroup of uncircumcised men who also are Ad5 seropositive, the risk appeared to be particularly high. The group who were uncircumcised and Ad5 seronegative was a fairly small group, so our confidence intervals were huge in that group. Again, these are all post-hoc analyses, so they're really all exploratory in nature, so I don't think we can draw any definitive conclusions. We can speculate about the potential mechanism by which lack of circumcision in the context of Ad5 and potentially without Ad5 might lead to an increased risk of acquisition from this vaccine, but we don't know those answers yet.
Does it remain a possibility that the difference that you saw in vaccine and placebo ultimately was about whether the person was circumcised or not versus the Ad5?
Yes, it's possible that this is really from circumcision and not a pre-existing Ad5 immunity. It's also possible that it's something that we've not yet measured. So I'll just again remind you that we haven't tested HSV2 serologies. That testing is underway, and there are other possible explanations. But the effect for circumcision seemed at least as strong, if not stronger, than for the Ad5.
Hi, Jari Chong from the LA Times. Various, I guess, results from the STEP study have kind of come out at various times in various places, so I was hoping you could maybe clarify what's new about the presentations that you guys gave today or what's new about the analysis that you presented.
Yeah, we've been trying to get the information out to the public as quickly as we have it. So we announced immediately, within 72 hours of our initial interim analysis, the crude infection rates. That's all that we had access to at that time. In November, at the HIV Vaccine Trials Network meeting, we presented the overall efficacy trial results. I repeated those today because many people here had not seen that. That was a relatively small meeting. What was new in my presentation were the multivariate analyses. There was this question, is it possible that this elevated number of infections in the vaccine group compared to the placebo group were just a matter of mismatching of other demographic or risk variables between the groups? And it does not appear that that was the case. And then we also were not, at that time, able to look at all of the factors, and we didn't know about the role of circumcision. We knew that there might be something going on with circumcision, but I think it's become clearer as we've done more models. I'll let Mike talk about most of the laboratory data are new that he presented today.
Yeah, so back in November, we did present just the basic gamma interferon LA spot data that I showed at the very beginning of my talk. All of the additional laboratory data was not shown at the HV10 meeting, so that dealing with the intracellular cytokine staining, both to the HIV transgenes and also to the vector-specific immunity, those are all very recent data, especially the anti-vector immunity is still, actually, we're still generating data, so even what I showed was just a partial data set. So that data is very new. Unfortunately, again, I don't think it's really provided much new change from what we saw before, so I think that kind of much as the multivariate analysis also basically reinforced the initial observations that we had. It just provides that with a little bit more clarity. Likewise, the laboratory data is important, but I don't think there's been anything there that has really demonstrated yet what any potential mechanisms might be. So I think there's still an enormous amount of ongoing work that has to be done from the laboratory standpoint, but much of that data that I showed was new.
I remember when the results came out, you were not certain whether the vaccine did increase the risk of acquisition of HIV. So as of today, how certain are you that the vaccine preparation does increase the risk of the acquisition?
I think all we can report on at this point is associations. We don't know definitively that the vaccine in some way caused an increase in susceptibility to infection. We know the vaccine did not infect anyone. Mike presented data that in which we explored a variety of hypotheses that might lead us to a mechanism by which it could increase infection. We've not seen any clear smoking gun. We don't have a reason or a mechanism yet that explains how the vaccine might have increased susceptibility to infection. All we can say is that on our multivariate analyses, after controlling for all of the measures that we have, it appears that there's an increased risk. It appears that that risk is particularly segregates with uncircumcised men and men who are Ad5 seropositive. Just also want to repeat that we can't really say anything about vaccine effects in women at this point because the number of infections was so low.
Sabin Russell at the Chronicle. I was wondering, given that you see this trend not abating for increased infections, have you done any kind of extrapolation of how many sort of unexpected infections might develop in this group that was tested? And are you considering or recommending or strongly recommending that the men who are in it be circumcised, who are uncircumcised now?
You know, again, I think what we've seen is an association of an increased number of infections in the vaccine group compared to the placebo group. We don't yet know that the relative increase overall in the entire cohort is relatively small. And so it's difficult for us to project. There are great confidence intervals around these estimates. If we were to look at this, again, it's not clear whether this is a true effect still or just an association that we're seeing. So we can't really project, oh, there's this number of excess infections. With regard to the question of circumcision, the data on circumcision in men who have sex with men is mixed. We have clear indication that circumcision helps to protect men from infection through heterosexual sex in Africa. We don't have those data for men who have sex with men. So at this point, I think it would be premature. We see this to recommend circumcision for the STEP study volunteers. We see this association. We still don't know if the association is circumcision itself or, for instance, some other sexually transmitted infection or some other mechanism. So, as I said, the post-hoc analyses are really to help us to explore, could this vaccine have had any untoward event, an unexpected event? And we need to investigate that fully because the safety of our study volunteers is always our primary consideration.
Hi, Jeff Berry, Positively Aware Magazine. This question is for Ron. Today, you asked a question, has the NIH lost its way? And I think you said that there were some promising signs that maybe there are some changes in that. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
It's my understanding that Dr. Fauci is planning what he's calling a summit meeting later in March to bring many of the leading investigators together to reevaluate, I think, the directions we're headed in, to draw up lists of where there are gaps in information that we can most aggressively pursue. And I think that holds promise for reshaping or redirecting where we're headed.
This is my personal opinion and maybe controversial, but as you all know, the money situation is not great at NIH. And on the other hand, at least in my view, the issue of prevention of HIV/AIDS is not the ordinary of all the ills of mankind. This is really, at least generally, considered to be a global crisis and from an epidemic point of view. And so one of the issues, in my view, is that the NIH should think about the AIDS vaccine development program as something that is not business as usual and set up maybe some more generous guidelines for creative and innovative research, because this really demands, I think you can justify, a somewhat special approach. And so this is not to criticize anybody, but simply say that I think that a lot of not just research community or the health community, but the world community would support a special effort here with, when you combine this major pandemic and an extraordinarily difficult scientific challenge, it calls for something a little special, at least in my opinion, and that would be justified. And maybe this summit that Ron makes reference to will take up that thought. But that's a personal opinion, and I'm not speaking for any institution.
Dr. Desrosiers, it's such a pleasure to pronounce at least the name correctly here.
For me.
Dr. Desrosiers, from what you said this morning and from the result and the target of the Merck vaccine, would your prevention regarding so-called therapeutic vaccination, I mean, does that mean for you that immunotherapy research has to step down also and go back to the bench and go back to basic science either?
I maybe should have done a better job clarifying that my comments really apply to preventive vaccine. I think I did use the word preventive once in the first sentence.
You made a great job.
Would it apply? There's nowhere near as much effort in the arena of therapeutic use of vaccines as there is as preventive. I think there are... we heard a very nice presentation from Chip Schooley this morning trying in one context looking at therapeutic vaccine. I think that there are some contexts where therapeutic vaccination may make sense. I'm thinking particularly in infants who get started on antiviral treatments very, very early and successfully on antivirals for 2 years or 3 years. And very often in those cases, the levels of the anti-HIV immune responses that you can measure are very, very low. So basically, they've been on effective drug treatment for so long, and the immune system has seen such little antigen that there's not much in the way to measure the immune responses. And I think in those individuals, if you can go in therapeutic immunization, boost their immune levels, and ask the question, can you now be better able to take them off antiviral drugs and let their immune responses control it? I think it's a very reasonable area to try, and I think my comments today really don't apply to those. Those experiments are going on and should go on.
Yeah, so this vaccine was also tested in Africa, in South Africa, in family assay. Do you have any results for that? I mean, was the same effect observed? And also, do you fear that volunteers would not be so...
There is a trial, kind of a sister trial to the STEP study called the Pambili trial that was initiated in South Africa. As soon as we had the results from the interim analysis of the STEP study, those results were obviously shared with that team as well. So just as we stopped vaccinations, any remaining vaccinations in the STEP study, they stopped further vaccinations in that trial as well. Now, that trial really was in its very early stages. There were only around 800 individuals enrolled in that. And furthermore, only 55, I believe, individuals had completed the entire vaccination series. So both the STEP study and the Pambili trial are continuing. We're not giving further vaccinations in those trials, but we are continuing to follow the individuals. Because the Pambili trial was so early and such a small number of people, there's really not data that I'm aware of that's available. You know, that team has not yet provided any data. We haven't seen that. So I think that it's premature to have any data from that. So I think, you know, right now we certainly don't have data from that trial. My understanding is that it's just too early to look at that, but they are definitely continuing to follow those participants very closely, as we are the participants in the STEP trial. So there's no data that I have that are available now. So,
can you say anything about public perception in South Africa of the stopping of the trial and anything that could be considered a backlash?
I'm not really part of that trial, so I probably shouldn't speak for them. I think that we've tried to coordinate the activities between the teams involved with that, and I think that, you know, they've, at least for the STEP study, as we've rolled out this information and done this, the participants have by and large been very, first off, disappointed with the results, but also they've just been amazing in a sense that they've been still saying, how can I continue to contribute? How can I help this effort? How can I be part of that? So for the STEP study, at least, I can say that, you know, the reaction has been very supportive from the community, that there's been a lot of engagement. And I think that the Pambili team has also made an incredible effort to reach out to the community there in South Africa, but I really wouldn't want to speak for them since I'm not really on that.
Well, here's my question. It was partially, people asked parts of it at the session, but not the whole thing. It's about the STEP study. It looks like, on the one hand, that in the placebo group, high 85 antibody titers were actually protective against HIV, and that the incidence rate of HIV decreased with increasing 85 titer. On the other hand, people that received the vaccine, the opposite occurred. The higher the 85 titer, the more HIV there was. Now, looking at this together, are people looking at these two things together? Because it looks like the vaccine actually obviated what was natural protection.
Oh, yeah. This all makes very little sense.
Right.
This is what happened. Is there an explanation that combines these two?
Yeah, I don't actually think, at the end of the day, AD5 was associated with an increased risk of infection. We're looking at this in other cohorts as well. But in our multivariate analysis, AD5 in and of itself was not associated with infection. I believe that the infection rate in the placebo arm was lower in the high AD5 titers because those people were predominantly coming from outside of North America. And the infection rates overall were lower in those groups because they were less likely to have known positive partners, and they use less substances. So I think that was just, that's the reason to do multivariate analyses, because of confounding from other demographic and risk variables. And so I believe that it's not about AD5, it's only potentially AD5 in the setting of vaccination. And as John asked before, could it be not AD5 at all? Could it just be circumcision? It could be.
Just to follow up, in the placebo group and in the vaccine group, all those characteristics were the same, right? You look at the people with high AD5 that received vaccine, people that had high AD5 that received placebo.
Yes.
The circumcision rates, all that stuff was the same. So they were comparable groups.
No, actually, it wasn't equal. People were not stratified to vaccine or placebo based on their circumcision status, and it wasn't equivalently distributed between those groups.
People with high AD5 titers did not have the same circumcision rate, whether they received vaccine or placebo? That was my question.
I mean, I think Susan has said this, but the real comparison should be between vaccine and placebo. People with low AD5 tended to be more from the U.S. They tended to have other demographic characteristics that were different. So you have to really look at the comparison between vaccine and placebo. That's where the randomization occurred. And likewise, and as Susan was alluding to, men with high AD5 titers in general in this study tended to be men that were less prevalent, less likely to be circumcised. So there's not absolute balance between all those things. That's really the point of a multivariate analysis, is try to accommodate all those different potential confoundings with that. So that was what we were trying to accomplish with the multivariate analysis.
I apologize if this has already been asked, but I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit more about why you think the vaccine didn't work, because it appears like you got the T-cell response that you'd hoped for.
Don't know why.
Yeah, I think that's the short answer.
Next. Don't know why. Being explored. No simple answer.
The answer to David's question, it's possible that lower rates of circumcision could be a marker for higher AD5 titers, but the rates of circumcision among the two groups should have been the same.
So, yes, circumcision rates, it looked as though the balance held, so I think that was your question. Within a stratum, when they were randomized, all of the various covariates looked similar in the two arms. They did. But there was this interaction between AD5 status, circumcision status, geography, risk, and all the rest of it. So the best way to tease out the independent contributions is through the multivariate analysis.
And importantly, the vaccine species that break through this vaccine haven't been characterized yet. That's a critical next step in identifying what broke through and whether there was any vaccine-selective pressure or not.
Yeah.
Clearly, a lot of decisions were made to move forward with a very expensive clinical trial that must have been predicated upon some assumptions, which in retrospect apparently weren't true. Simultaneously, you have NEF-deleted attenuated vaccines that appear to confer protection, which I would infer from that there must be some understanding of what the correlative immunity might be, or at least we should know something about that. And what I'm wondering is, upon reflection, can you identify, or is it possible to identify, what the mistake was in the decision process of saying, yeah, we should move forward with this now? What was that based upon that was compelling enough to decide to involve that many people and that much money, that in retrospect turns out not to be something you can depend on as a way of learning for the future? Does this make sense?
Yeah, I'll make a very quick statement. I don't think it was a mistake to move forward. I think that we need experiments in order to determine how best to move forward. There's reasonable discussion about when it's appropriate to move forward with clinical trials, but I think this isn't an either-or situation. We clearly need the non-human primate studies. We also clearly need the clinical trials. I think we've all said that, and that what we've all said is that the question is always, when do we have enough data to think that this is promising enough? We felt that there was enough promise, that this was really clearly the most robust cell-mediated immune response that had been seen in an HIV vaccine, and we have a huge epidemic on our hands. And so we need to do appropriately timed clinical trials to gather information about what works and what doesn't. We're getting an enormous amount of information from the STEP study. It's not a failed trial. It actually answered the question in a very clean and clear way that we set out to answer. And it will give us a lot of information both about why it didn't work, as John said, to look at was there any selective pressure on the virus? Was it not a good match with the viral variants that broke through? Was there an issue of lack of breadth? Was it a magnitude? Was it a quality of immune response? So we now will be getting a lot of information that will also inform which of the many, as Neil talked about, the many non-human primate models may be most appropriate. It helps us to eliminate some and to refine others.
But I think you, young man, put the finger on causes of disagreement and discussion at the present time on how decisions can and should be made and the directions we should be in.
The path forward is not clear, okay? That I think there's agreement on that. Anybody who talks about a timeline for a vaccine is being silly and uninformed, that it will require an incremental process of knowledge and experimentation and testing of ideas. It's pretty clear that we can't do that, even though this trial was conducted in record time. An experiment can't last almost 3 years. We'll all be very old or gone if that is our iterative cycle. So we need to drop back and design better experiments, and through some serendipity and some prepared insight, we'll make progress. But the timeline of that progress is as cloudy as it ever was.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.